Hello, and welcome to Unstuffing Our Story with me, Catrice Horsley. On today's show, I'm interviewing the amazing Aisha Jones, and we're talking about how we have to deconstruct our lives to reconstruct them, how astrology has helped her in particular find a way of being literate in her life and recognizing the patterns and the constellations that lie within it. And also we talk about how she has used her art form, photography, to help separate herself from some of the events in her lives so she can get nearer to them. I'm really happy that she agreed to be part of the show, and I'm incredibly happy that you can listen to her wisdom and we can all be awestruck together. So welcome, Aisha Jones, speaking to us from Coventry in the West Midlands in the UK. I'm really happy that you agreed to be a guest on the show, because I've been not only inspired by the work that you do as a photographer, but also inspired by your journey as a human being who continues to grow and develop and inspire others. So welcome very much to the Unstuffing Our Story podcast. How are you?
Thank you so much, Kushi. That was such like a lovely introduction. You're making me go all red now.
It's allowed. I normally start the questions off with a general question about sharing with the listeners your story, however you choose to define your story, whether it's a quest or whether it's a story of overcoming, and perhaps even what kind of a character you've played in your lives, like a trickster or a heroine, or sometimes even some of us have played a shadow character because we've basically messed ourselves up in our lives, that we've sabotaged ourselves. So do you want to share with the listeners a little bit about your story in becoming who you are now?
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting what you say about different characters, because I literally think all the time, looking back on my life, I've been so many different types of people. Just, you know, physically how I look, and also mentality and behavior and things. And you kind of think, well, where am I going to be going to, like what kind of person am I now going to be becoming? But yeah, okay, let's start at the beginning then. Who was I originally before I changed and adapted? I think like I've always been really inquisitive and kind of like analytical about how things work and like who I am and my identity and how the world works. And I think that's probably come from always being the other, or like being different. So, you know, being female, dual heritage, having spinal deformity growing up, dyslexia, there's always been something which people have been able to point out or make a comment on. So I think I've always been really inquisitive and analyze myself, like why are people saying this and why is the world like this, and those thoughts and those things coming at you at such a young age, your brain develops in that way, and I kind of, you know, carry that into my adult life now.
I always say that when you're young, you never question the stories or responses that are reflected to you about yourself, and so they become the marrow of your identity. Question it, you just swallow it.
And I one story that comes to mind was in year four, and we were all asked to draw a picture of God, which is a very weird thing to ask children to do. And I remember I drew a picture of a white man, but I made sure I left a note on it saying that God is nature, but if he was a man, this is what he'd look like.
How did your teacher respond to that?
They never said it. I don't remember them saying anything, but I always remember being proud of that. Like, I know what you're trying to get me to say and what you're trying to get me to draw, but I've got my own opinion on this.
I remember being expelled from my Catholic secondary school. Not expelled, you know, when you're sent away for a couple of days. What's that? Suspended.
Yeah.
From my Catholic secondary school, because I'd been studying early man, and I was trying to kind of put this early man, like a Neanderthal man and Cro-Magnon man, in terms of we are made in the image of God. So if the earliest man looked slightly ape-like, then perhaps our whole idea of what God looks like is wrong.
Oh, I bet they didn't
and
like
the
that.
Nun, oh, Sister Elizabeth threw me out. She threw me out, she did. But it sounds like you've been a seeker.
Yeah.
If there was an archetype, a seeker.
Yeah, and I always remember just looking at nature and like seeing the raindrops on like spiders' webs and just like being like, wow. And I remember having this thought as well. I was like, I wonder if life's like those Russian dolls where there's like a doll within a doll within a doll. I was like, I wonder if there's a doll playing with me and then a doll playing with that doll. Yeah, those are the kind of thoughts I had when I was like 5, 6 years old. Yeah, I've definitely been a seeker.
I love it.
And then I think when I started to develop spinal deformity, curvature of the spine, which is basically my spine from the age of 12 started to grow in like an S shape and then also rotate round, so it caused like a rib hump on the right side of my back. And so like, I was always very conscious of people looking at my body and my back, and people poking, what's that? What's happening to your body? And then there's just other asymmetrical things that it caused in my torso. And so it's just, I tried to kind of work out why this had happened to me, and was there kind of a spiritual reason or a physical thing that I could work on to kind of correct it? And when we went to the doctors to get a second opinion, he like bent me forward to show me what my back would eventually look like if I didn't go through with the surgery. They were saying I needed to get spinal fusion surgery, and the second doctor kind of, and he told me that I'd end up growing into a pretty girl with an ugly back.
I
know. And this is another moment I'm really proud about, where I turned to him, and I was such a quiet child, like I would never say things to like adults and things, but I turned to him and I was like, it's not going to be ugly, it's just going to be different. And then I was like, right,
good for you,
I'm gonna show you. And then I just spent the next, I don't know, 10 years trying alternative therapies and things to kind of ease the pain and prevent it from getting any worse. But then, yeah, when I was in my 20s, I did have the operation because the pain did get a lot worse.
Unbearable.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued at that. I was talking on the previous podcast to Sandra, and I talked to my husband a fair bit about when we are doing something or making a change in ourselves to show somebody else. It's like, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show. And then that person still has some control over us because we're not doing it because we delight in doing it or it comes from a need in us. Yeah. It's a need to show somebody else. So I know that started off, like you saying to him, it's going to be different. But was there a time when you stopped doing it because of somebody else and just did it because of yourself?
I think after I started university, and actually it ties in quite well with now talking about my photography, because it was through using photography as a documentary tool, and kind of I used it to analyze my life. Basically, I did a whole project about the female sexuality and the way capitalist systems and, you know, the world distorts our sense of what it means to be a woman. And then within that, I was then looking at my heritage and the women in my family. And then I tied in my scoliosis and how I tried to get into modeling, but like prove that I could do anything. But then that kind of distorted my sense of what it meant to be a woman as well. And then feeling like I had this hidden thing underneath my clothes, which wasn't pretty, which wasn't attractive. And then that project really kind of helped me unpick that and realize that I was doing things for other people a lot more than I realized. And so going forward after that, I was like, okay, I can take this load off now. Who am I? What do I want? How do I want to show up in the world? And I think through doing that project, I was like, well, I can get the operation now because it's not, you know, I'm no longer doing it because I don't want your prophecy to come true. It's like, well, okay, this is going to help me and this is going to make me feel more comfortable in my body So yeah, it just helped me let go of a lot of those things that I was holding on to, and caring a bit less how I was showing up for other people.
So at that point, in some ways, you took ownership of your own story.
Yeah, I'd say that.
Or you became aware that you could start to take ownership of this story, that you could narrate it, you can write your story. And it's not in terms of fitting into the chapters that other people have written about you and how you should be.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Because I think because of the project, it helped me actually put my life onto paper. Like, I could actually see how things had progressed. And so I was able to actually see what my story was. Before that, it was like you just living unconsciously, just going through life without a real kind of bird's eye view on things.
I love that you've said that, because I think often when we're working with our personal stories, particularly, we're so close to them, we can't see them.
Yeah.
And we have to put the story outside of ourselves. So if I'm working with people and we're looking at their stories, quite often I get them to use bits of rope and buttons and junk materials to notate their life. And so there's a distance between them and their life. There's a space between it now, a physical space. And because there's a distance between them and their life, they can get nearer to their life. So in some ways, your photographs gave you distance enough from your experience to lean into it.
Yeah, definitely. I love that.
So I'm thinking about what you've shared with parts of your story so far, and that idea of you being a seeker, but also a little bit of a champion, you know, a fighter. Yeah?
Yeah,
it's like, you're not going to show me. Yeah. You're not going to tell me. I'll give you the finger, yeah, kind of thing. the anarchistic seeker. And I'm wondering, on your quest to become who you are now, and we can talk about that a little bit more, and going through that story, if you think of stories in terms of we meet helpers who give us lovely gifts and we have to battle with demons, and either we conquer the demons or we make friends with them, and we tame them and somehow accept them into our lives, who would you see as, and what would you see as, some of the helpers and some of the challenges, the main helpers and challenges? Because I think this might lead into your journey to Africa.
Definitely.
Because I think, yeah.
I mean, obviously the first person that comes to my mind is my mum. She's just always, you know, been supportive. And my dad as well, they've both been supportive of my journey. But it's a hard one, because I feel like everyone's a helper. Like, everyone I've come into contact with, you know, they're showing me something about myself, or even the ones who have not been so nice to me, you know, people who've kind of laughed at me not being able to spell things right. It's kind of pushed me to then become better, and like, okay, well, again, it's how I'll show you things.
Yeah.
Like, my mum is just the person I always go to for help. Like, I'm quite, like, I kind of don't really like to ask for help from others that much. And I think that's quite, like, that can be quite problematic, because you feel like you can do everything, but you can't. But I think on my journey, the main person which kind of helped me, or group of people which have helped me overcome a lot of challenges, is a lot of astrologers that I listen to, and I've got really into astrology. And so there's a woman called Raquel Spring, and I've kind of joined up to her mentorship program. And it's just giving me, again, we were talking about that bird's eye view look on your life. So it's almost like I see it as like a language, and like, it gives me an ability to like look at things and look at my life in a very detached way, and like put the pieces together and kind of work out what my next steps are. So I think learning more about astrology has really, really helped me, kind of like giving me a life booster in a way, in my self-development.
So there's two things in what you've just said that I find really interesting. The one thing is about giving you this objective view. And I think as a photographer, and as a person who's photographed yourself in your documentary of your life, you have to be objective in looking at photographs. So something about being a photographer and being objective and viewing your life. And then this idea of astrology almost as a notational device, like you now have you're literate in how to notate your life with the help of astrology. And, you know, astrology is about constellations and meaning. And when we look at our life, there are so many different patterns in it that we miss. And astrology is all about patterns, constellations and relationships.
Exactly. And it's funny because I always think that it's this, that the same skill that I have in my photography, the same thing, skill I'm drawing on when I'm reading someone's astrology chart. It's like the same energy. It's like you're born with your gifts and your skill sets, or you develop certain ones in your life, and it can be used in different contexts. And it's very much like you're saying, astrology is like a picture of your life, or a picture of an energy that you're reading. And, you know, going through university, we were taught about how looking at images in a very matter-of-fact way, but then it's like, well, what's the things that's going on behind the image? What can we draw out from the meaning of this image, and what does this mean, and what's that defining moment? Why does this image make this a really powerful one? You know, so I was looking at images deeper than, say, the average Joe, who just like, oh, that's nice bunch of flowers there. You know, it's like, well, what do the flowers mean, and who might have left them there?
There's your seeker again. You talk about what's the defining moment in that image, or what story is that image portraying or trying to portray, what is hidden behind it. And I'm wondering about in your life, what would be the defining moments of your story, do you think?
So there's lots. I think scoliosis was one with the doctor, and then kind of what people were saying to me. And then I think more recently it would be moving to Africa and the experiences I had there, and having my son, and then leaving my ex-husband. I think that was a very defining moment.
It would be difficult for that not to be defining. Yeah.
I think I had to have a very hard look at myself through that time, and realizing that my mind had been manipulated to such a degree, and having to come out of that and reset my perspective. Like, oh my God, how was I even able to be in that situation? How was my mind able to be manipulated without knowing it? Because I thought I was observant. I thought I could see things coming. I thought I could read people really well. And the fact that I was faced with that I had this massive blind spot was like mad.
That is not a unique story. That idea of one's perception of oneself and one's world being totally altered through the lens of another.
Yeah.
And especially for me, one of the features of that is quite often with women who I know, and I've only known women who this has happened to. I'm not saying it doesn't happen to men, but I've only known women who it's happened to. It's very incremental.
Yes.
You know, and they're strong, feisty women, strong, feisty, powerful women. And then something happens, like a drip, 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 drip. And it just washes away the core of their self-belief, their identity. Yeah. And then when they come to somehow, they're like, my God, where did I go to, and how did that happen?
Yeah, and then you have to rebuild yourself, but you come back a whole lot stronger. Like, once you've rebuilt those blocks, like, there's no breaking that wall down again. Because it was quite interesting how I was able to go from this feminist activist who was, like, you know, showing up at protests outside Tesco, and I was like, just thinking that my place as a woman was cooking and cleaning and all the things that they were saying, which for some women it is, and that's fine, and they're happy in that role.
Yeah,
but for me, that wasn't the expression that I was here to express as a woman. And so, like, how did I get from that to that, and then was out of that situation, then rebuilding that, and now I feel a lot more stronger in my sense of who I am and I'm here to do.
In some ways, those things help you identify your building blocks. you know, this is what's really important, and this is what's really important, and this is what's really important. Yeah, because I really do believe that we can't rebuild our stories unless we deconstruct them.
Yeah, and I think everybody has, like you said, that defining moment. Everybody has that defining moment, and it's there. It's there to initiate you into your power as a human being. It's the hero's story, the hero's journey of, you know, going through the challenge and the dark side of life to then come out. You can't see darkness coming, or you can't see whatever you want to call it, evil or whatever. You can't see that unless you've dipped your toe into that world, unless you've experienced it. I think that's where the power lies as well, because it's like, okay, well, if all of this is showing me something about myself, that means I've got power to change it, because I can change it. The only thing I have power over is myself. And so what do I need to work on so that never comes into my reality again?
Most potent work is, I think, working with those things that make us incredibly uncomfortable. I said on one of the previous podcasts that we are beholden as human beings to lean into the stuff that makes us really uncomfortable, because that's where the proper work happens. And certainly for me, as a white cisgender woman, leaning into racism, leaning into homophobia, leaning into a lot of the stuff that I was told as a child, and that I didn't really swallowed, and then you don't really want to admit it, but you have to deconstruct it, stick your finger in the saw, pull it about a bit in order to go, oh shit, yeah, that's not very nice, I need to clear that shit up. I'm not going to keep that there.
And people are scared to do it because they're scared of their reality being questioned, or they're scared that they're going to be seen as the bad person. But I think if you're going into it with honesty and a clean heart, like, even if I am the bad person, do you know what, I'm going to accept it, and I know I can change it. Like, you'll just get so many gifts coming out when you have that sense of honesty about you. And yeah, and you see it in a lot of kind of institutions and things are wanting to kind of get more black voices in and this and that, and then, you know, we go in and we say, well, this is the things that you're gonna have to change, you're gonna have to change it from the top down, you know, we can't just bring a lot of brown people into these events, we can have to change the top down. And it's like, oh, does that mean I'm gonna have to change something about myself? And then they're like, oh, maybe. So yeah, if you go in there with honesty, like, okay, well, let's see what we can do then. Okay, I don't agree with that, but maybe we could do this. And then it's like, oh my god, my business is flourishing, and I'm making, you know, because they went in with that sense of honesty and what was needed.
Carry on. I'm loving it. I'm loving the conversation. It's honesty and vulnerability. You have, because, you know, you have to open yourself up for somebody to go around and say, actually, you're not a very nice person with those views. And you're like, oh, shit, those views aren't good views. So you have to be really quite vulnerable, which is something a lot of us will shy away from. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've just reading a really good book called Cassandra Speaks by a woman called Elizabeth Lesser.
Okay.
And it's very much about how the world would be different if women had written the stories rather than where are the women's voices. And it is that idea of the change has to, you have to be active externally. So social activism, change communities, change and challenge culture. But also, you can't do that without the internal work.
Yeah.
So she has coined the phrase innivism and activism.
Oh, I like
so
that.
So the innivism, nice kind of personal change, where you're sitting there going, yeah, this is uncomfortable, you've got to just stick with it. And then that makes you better able to do the activism. The activism is actually easier than the innivism. It's a good book,
definitely, because that's where the world change is gonna happen. Because I always say as well, like, it comes to kind of changing the world, or changing, say, like, for example, the black community, I'm like, well, it starts at home. Like, how am I raising my son? How am I being as a mother? Like, and then where's my son going to go on to in his life, and how's he going to raise his kids and having that long term, like those little things that start inside or in the home or in.
But I love you saying that, because I think, especially at the moment, we are under a tsunami of negativity. When we look at the news, it's not just that it's bad news, it's violent.
Yeah.
It's deaths, it's destruction. It's, you know, destruction of the world, nature, the climate, destruction of people, black people getting shot because they're black. There is such acute rape as a system of war.
Yeah.
And you can get frozen in that and you'll turn away from it because you feel, I can do nothing to change it.
Yeah.
I can't stop those women being raped by soldiers. I can't stop that. But actually, if we focus in on, but I can do this.
Yeah.
I can raise my son to respect women.
Yeah.
I can. And that, it empowers us. It makes us feel that we are doing something, and it gives us some kind of small current of resistance against this huge, overwhelming negativity that we're, because it's not all negative, the world is not all negative, yeah, but it's what we're shown, you know. Yeah. It's what is shown to us,
and that's like, that's the much wiser approach as well, because you know we've all got a limit on the amount of energy we've got to expend on things. And you know, I've been there, being an activist and wanting to do this and wanting to do that, and then you're just drained and tired and you can't show up for the people who matter in your own life. But then if you use that energy, if everybody on the planet used that energy in their own environment, it would just naturally change. Like, it's just,
that's exactly
osmosis.
It.
Like, yeah, it's just going to happen.
I'm wondering, you know, going back to this idea of your story and who were your helpers and who were your beasts that you had to fight against and what were the defining moments. I'm wondering, what does your art form and what does your work provide you with?
It's like a sense of purpose in, like, when I'm doing my own projects and my own photography or video, I feel like it gives me energy, it gives me happiness, it gives me joy. So it's like that's from that feeling, I know that that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So the things which are more draining, although they have to be done, I know that that's not necessarily what I'm here, the main reason I'm here for. And so it gives me that drive to keep going and to keep pushing and to keep working on myself, because there's certain stories or there's certain things that I need to expose or I need to show in the world.
The other question that I have before we go on to our quickfire questions is, based on the story that you have lived and where you are now in your story, what gift have you received or what wisdom that you could pass on to somebody else if you were their helper with a gift?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is, really, instead of focusing on what other people are saying, what makes you happy, what brings you joy, what makes you feel relaxed, at ease, at peace, and just do those things. Like, when you're, you know, when you're feeling those negative feelings or thinking negative thoughts, you really have to push and think, what can I physically do to change?
Yes, we sometimes have a phrase, myself and somebody I know very well, we call it the spiral of despair. So, because once you're on it can suck you down into that, like, so to that spiral before it goes deeper, and go or do something that gives you joy or comfort.
And also, like, sometimes going down that spiral can feel good. Like, you can almost be addicted to, it's like a slide or like a rollercoaster. This, I know this is bad, but it feels so good to feel this bad. What feels uncomfortable and the hard work is climbing up the mountain and climbing back up that hill or that slide to get to get to a better place. So once you're exposed to this way of thinking, or you've come to this way of thinking, that's where it really starts, because you're now becoming conscious of things. I think it's more dangerous when you're on that path, not realizing that, okay, when I'm on a slippery slope, it feels good. Or did it have that reference point? It's like, oh, okay, I know this is happening because of this.
It's really interesting what you're saying again in terms of that, with regards to what you said about being able to be objective and look at your life in photographs and become lean nearer to it, because there's a space between you and it. And it's almost like you need that when you're identifying those kind of negative patterns that you can get into. You need to be externally conscious of them in order to then decide, I will go down and I'll purge myself in these negative thoughts, but it's going to be shit coming back up. Or I'm choosing not to.
Exactly that.
It's so knackering being conscious.
It really is. I know. It's that hero's fight. Like, if you want to come on this earth and evolve as a human being and have like die in a better place than where you were when you were born, like, you have to go up that hill.
Yeah. So, Aisha, with all of my guests, I ask them a series of quick fire questions. So, are you ready?
I'm ready.
First question is, what was your favourite story as a child?
The one that's coming to mind, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's a book about a little girl who wants to turn into a crocodile.
I love that.
And then the mum's going, well, if you were a crocodile, you couldn't have friends over for tea, you couldn't have sleepovers, and you couldn't have chocolate, and then you'd have to live in a swamp, and because basically she wants to turn into a crocodile so that she can do whatever she wants, and that she doesn't have to go to bed, and she doesn't have to eat what she doesn't want, and da 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 da, but she doesn't think about the consequences of actually being that crocodile. And then at the end of the story, she's like, oh yeah, actually no, I think I'll just stay as I am.
But I love that in terms of what we were saying earlier about you, like, I'm just going to do what I want to do, and you're not going to tell me, I'm going to be a crocodile.
That's exactly it.
I love this this image of you as this wild child. When I was young, because I didn't speak, I had a speech defect when I was young, and one of my earliest memories was when I was at primary school, so I would have been about 5. And I was pretty wild. My mum used to lock me in the bedroom because I had lots of tantrums. But I didn't speak at school. So I was this silent, raging, curly-haired, small beast. And there was a girl who was picking on me and my sister because our last name's Horsley. And she was calling us like horse face and horse poo and horse whatever. Oh, and she was in my sister's year. Anyhow, I just ran at her and bit her arm. I was a fighter.
Like, well, you're going to call me an animal, here you go.
And I can remember there were teeth marks in her upper arm. And that's terrible.
Thing, you don't push the quiet ones, because I'm the same as well. Like, people think that I'm just like a quiet, timid person, but once you push me or hit that button,
I've got the rage, man. I've got the Irish rage.
Got the rage.
Right, second question. And I want you to finish this sentence. Creating our own lived stories requires
bravery.
Nice. Bravery, courage. Yeah, it does. What sustains you right now, Aisha? What is sustaining you in this time?
Astrology, I think. Because I'm finding this year such an interesting year watching the astrology play out. Just because kind of last year, all the astrologers were saying 2020, this and that, it's going to be, you know, these alignments only happen when there's world wars and this and that. And then actually seeing the year unfold, I'm like, oh my God, I'm believing this a whole lot more. And then so there's another alignment happening in December. So I'm just really fascinated to see how...
Now you literally have me thinking, I just need to go and educate me on this stuff. What movies or books or series or documentaries would you recommend to the listeners at the moment that you've seen recently that you've gone, oh yeah, that's interesting, that was good fun?
I'm really boring in terms of fun things. I always watch or read things which are like self-development or things which are
like me.
Astrology or At the moment, I'm listening to an audio book by, I think you pronounce it, Evie Pomporis, which is called Becoming Bulletproof. And she's basically an ex-US Secret Service officer, and she's kind of using the skills she learned through, being bodyguards for the president and things like that, in terms of like how you can become bulletproof in your mindset and how you can get through life, and read people and protect yourself and all that kind of stuff. So I'm finding that quite interesting at
It
the
no, but even when you said that, it was a female like bodyguard. I
moment.
actually felt myself sit up a little bit straighter.
Yeah, and
I
that's
was
what I
like,
love as well. And the way she's talking is very feminine as well. When I interrogate people, I'm not in there to scare them. I'm in there to make them feel comfortable, and that's how I get my information, by listening to them. I'm a very active listener, and I empathize even with the most evil person. You can find some good in them. I'm empathize, and I draw that the goodness out, and then they're more likely to confess. And I'm like, yes, this is what we need.
I was reading a piece of research the other day, which links into this. When that the research that says that if we're under real pressure or danger, it's a fight, flight, or freeze. Have you heard that? And everybody quotes that fight, flight, and freeze. That was done in the 1930s, and the only people who were part of that research were men.
Wow. I didn't know
White
that.
men.
Wow.
Exactly. So that was discovered. So a woman looked at that psychotherapist, and she was like, "What the hell?" In the early 2000s. And she did research on women in those situations and also like female primates. So if a female primate is going to be attacked by another, she grooms them. She sits them down and she kind of takes the fleas out of them.
Wow.
And from that research, what a lot of women, and it's not every single woman and every single man, but the pattern that turned out was that women tend to nurture and nest. So when you've got groups of women who are being oppressed, they will create links and relationships. And if you have, and this is like a huge exaggeration, but if you have a guy and another guy comes up with a knife, the guy might either think, right, I can take the knife off him, or I'm going to run away from here, whatever. But a woman might say something like, "Do you have a sister? Do you have a mom?" And you'll almost try to enter into a relationship with that person in order to disempower and kind of take the whole thing down.
Yeah,
Isn't that
that is so
fascinating?
fascinating, and I can so understand that as well. Because it's that it comes down to that emotional intelligence as well, which everyone has it, and but it can be seen as a feminine quality where you're able to
Yeah,
read
exactly.
people and know how to adjust yourself in order to get a certain response or a certain reactive. And on the negative end of the spectrum, it can be seen as manipulative. But if you're using it for the good, yeah, I can see how in a dangerous situation you can really use that. Oh, I love that you said that. Thank you for that.
Well, yeah, look it up. Fight, flight, response, and gender. And you'll see the re because I my head was totally blown. It was like, what the hell? Because I've been quoting that research left, right, and center. Who knew? Yeah. So the last question, lovely, lovely Aisha, who I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking to. The last question is, what is the most important story that we should be carrying right now?
Oh, just an honest one. Whatever the story is, make sure it's honest, and you're not afraid to share that.
I 100% can absolutely relate to that.
This
Yeah, because
interesting.
sometimes we don't want to be authentic because we think it will hurt people. But at what point do we actually have to be honest, even if it's hurtful?
I think whatever's meant to happen or whatever is meant to come out of a certain situation or conversation, it can only come out through being authentic and honest. Like, I think as humans, we get stuck in our ego a bit too much. We're like, well, I want this outcome, and da da da. So, and then we kind of create an unauthentic approach to something. But if we kind of just let go of that and just channel whatever needs to come out, is then we leave room for whether you call it God, the universe, whatever you associate that with. That's what you kind of allow to come out when you're kind of giving up that control, I think.
So, Aisha, thank you so much for being our guest today on Unstuffing Our Story. I feel energized, I feel more positive, and I feel more hopeful after talking to you. And I'm absolutely bloody 100% sure that the listeners will feel the same way. Thank you so much for being the guest
today.
Oh,
thank you, Catrice. I was smiling from like ear to ear, honestly. Oh, I've loved it so much. And all the same to you. So I'm filled with joy. And I'm going to go about my day now with like lots of energy and like ready to go. So thank you for having me.
You are welcome. Have the most glorious of days. You take care of
and
yourself.
You.
And greetings to all of your family and loved
Thank
ones.
Thank you. You too, Katrina. Speak to you soon.
Okay.
Bye bye. Bye.
Next week, we have the amazing Rebecca Hemmings on the show. And it is going to be next week and not in 2 weeks because of Christmas coming up. Rebecca's going to share her story regarding how breast cancer affected and changed her life and changed the kind of happy ever after that she thought she was going to have and how she tamed it, that wild beast cancer, and made it into something positive. And how in natural fact she's a healthier person now in many ways than she was before. So come and join me next week, listen to the story that she has to share, and let us all find meaning in it together. And please remember to join us on our Instagram page, Unstuffing Our Story, and hit subscribe on the podcast. Also, if you want to, you could always leave a little review. That would be very helpful. So, I look forward to you joining us next week with Rebecca Hemmings. There's more information about her on the Instagram page, so go take a look. Bye for now.